anything certainly involves elusive reasoning. Measuring happiness via economics seems to me more elusive still. Yet today's guest, Mark Anielski, professor of social responsibility and author of The Economics of Happiness, Building Genuine Wealth, is standing on some firm ground. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
The fact that the world needs a professor of social responsibility makes me wonder, is this a good sign or a bad sign?
Well, it's an interesting sign. I've actually been teaching this for 10 years. Some people say that if you need a position of corporate social responsibility in an organization, that might be actually a bad sign, or at least a sign of what's missing in the world, which I think is actually an absence of ethics and understanding of what virtue is, particularly in the business world.
Yes, certainly. You present in an article, Is Economics Failing Us? And I felt like that was kind of like saying, Mommy, my milk's spilled.
Well,
what's really failing us here?
Well, it's failing us in the sense of we've forgotten that and I think economists, I can blame economists, that the word economics means household stewardship or management from the Greek. And I think economists have gotten lost in their mathematical formulations and focus on sort of money metrics of growth, and have forgotten that economics is really a concern about the well-being of a household, of a community, and of a nation, and including the environment, which in ecology in Greek means household knowledge or logic. So it's logia. So it's this call is to return back to the original idea of economy as Aristotle kind of defined it, and the Greeks understood it.
Yes, and I love, while we're speaking of word origins, you also speak about the origins of the words wealth, value, and competition. They also are certainly at the very basis of what you're speaking about with your redefined or refocus on what economy is all about.
That's correct. So as I tell my business students, the word competition comes from the Latin competere, which means to strive together. So actually to cooperate. So paradoxically, that word's kind of being twisted. The word wealth, I didn't realize until I started to look at the origins of these words, means the conditions of well-being, 13th century old English definition. And even Adam Smith didn't define the word wealth in the old English terms. So I came to the conclusion that, in a sense, we've almost like inverted all the language. And, words are powerful, so when we use these words, we're speaking a truth, but in a sense, we're not understanding their original intent.
Right, and mortgage is one.
And mortgage meaning a death pledge in French, So it's just bizarre that, and we, it's kind of like the movie in The Matrix, are we awake or are we aware of what, in fact, we are speaking about?
Yes, certainly. And I'm aware of John Keynes quite literally because of an economics 101 class.
Yeah.
And that was the extent of study in economics as far as my life went. But I love the quote that I read that you wrote about of his, and perhaps my whole vision of economics would have been changed had I known this, and I'll read that quote right now. The day is not far off when the economic problem will take the back seat where it belongs, and the area of the heart and head will be occupied or reoccupied by our real problems, the problems of life and of human relations, of creation, behavior, and religion.
And doesn't that just give you goosebumps?
Yes, and it really reminded me of the rumored deathbed scene of Louis Pasteur when he admitted that, it's not because of an outside bug that's going to really get us. It's our interior environment that really is happening and causing things like this to happen. So it's beautiful that in your book, The Economics of Happiness, that's your starting off point.
This is what really shocked me, that, you know, when you go back to the founding fathers and mothers of certainly the economics since World War II, you find these incredible statements. Simon Kuznets, to the U.S. economist who designed the national income accounting GDP system, said some remarkable things. He said eventually after the war, we would grow up and start to measure things like health and diet and all these things that really contribute to well-being. So those challenges are still in front of us, and it's remarkable after so many years since the war, we still really have not, in a sense, grown up.
Right. Well, when you start looking at that, it's pretty interesting where the growth of the pharmaceutical companies are considered to be part of what's growing and large in America and is really adding to those numbers. And yet it's totally at the cost of our health.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And a false economy where the more we spend on, drugs and treatment of cancers, the more the GDP grows versus investing and, healthy eating and understanding how our bodies work. If we spent more time there, we'd actually forgo some of those expenditures and the GDP actually wouldn't grow as much. So it's kind of a paradox.
Right. And it really makes me wonder about even looking at statistics.
Mm-hmm.
Because the whole system of measurement is askew. It's just really not serving anything.
Exactly. We have to keep asking, are we measuring what matters? There is a crisis of confidence in the statistics. And I've been dealing with indicators all my life, and I could tell you most of them are inadequate. They don't really get to the heart of people's lived experience. And we believe that they're objective. We believe they have meaning. They inform us to a certain degree, but they sort of lack in meaning, in a sense, in genuineness.
Your book, The Economics of Happiness, is talked about. You've spoken with people that attend these world banking meetings. It's used for study. How do you see it literally getting off the page into the heart and becoming a part of that experience within our lives? Because just like doing homework, the human race, we only do our homework when it's due the next morning.
This is the challenge that I see is that we live in a way the paradox of prosperity. So we live in relatively safe and prosperous times. And yes, there are crises, and most of these are actually artificial. The financial crisis is mostly artificial, but that's another conversation. So I always say the journey to happiness begins with, an examination of one's own conscience and one's own life and to assess whether one's life is congruent with, why you believe you're here on this planet, which, it's kind of a spiritual thing.
Very much so, yes.
Very much, and that's actually paradoxically what, maybe not, what happiness means. It means well-being of the spirit, eudaimonia in Greek. So happiness really is a spiritual journey. If your spirit is not at peace, then the world is not at peace. And most of us are unfortunately filled with anxiety about things like debt and mortgages, and these are actually unfortunate distractions from the genuine pursuit of happiness, as Thomas Jefferson, I think, originally envisioned. So it's a call to actually return back to those original conversations. I'm a Canadian. I'm looking at Jefferson and going, wow, these guys were they were pretty progressive, and they were bold, and they made statements like the pursuit of happiness. They didn't say it was guaranteed. But it's time for us to, I think, return to that original vision and rediscover the wisdom of that, in fact, what's true about our lives is that there's abundance. There are great gifts sitting in our households and our communities, and the fundamental basis of actually a happy life is strong relationships. So you know, this is reclaiming our pursuit of happiness, really, I think, should be our agenda.
Yes, there's two comments I have about that. One is you're dead on, of course, about the relationship, and if we are secure in relationship and we follow that, of course, with our family, with our community, with our food, you know, every aspect of our lives can be drawn. If we have a good straight line to any one of those, it strengthens ourselves. And the fact that all of these games go on with the financial world, creating that illusion of financial crisis, which of course filters down into most of our lives. There are very few of us that aren't affected by that. And then moving on into what you're talking about, Jefferson, I was looking at that this morning and I was really feeling like maybe it was some kind of a cosmic setup from the beginning for us in America, using those words of Thomas Jefferson, the pursuit of happiness. I mean, right there, it's almost implied or suggested that it's something we need to go out and find and go after.
Absolutely. And if you, you know, and I've read some of Jefferson's works, and, you know, I think he would agree that the pursuit of happiness is ultimately an individual interior journey, but there's a shared responsibility for the collective wheel or the common wheel, the well-being of the community. And now, you know, he was a profound philosopher, and he expounded on the idea of happiness as well. And I, you know, won't go into all those details, but, you know, just to reread those works to say, you know, and I always remark on he didn't say that happiness was guaranteed. He said it was the pursuit, right? So it is always something we aspire to. And now I don't know if Jefferson actually defined happiness in the Greek term, but he undoubtedly understood that happiness had something to do with your spirit.
The subtitle to your book is Building Genuine Wealth, and you certainly took some good time and thought with all of this. Why don't you share some of the aspects of this genuine wealth and what that means?
So the two words, you know, excuse me, genuine meaning to be authentic, to live, as I say, according to values. Now, that for some people, that's a pretty loaded word. What is genuine to me might be different to you. And that, though, reflects maybe the diversity of our values. So if we're living congruent with our values, then presumably we are at a greater peace with ourselves and with the world. And the word wealth, as I said, in the Old English means the conditions of well-being. Wella means well-being, and those two letters, TH, means the conditions of something. So health and wealth are actually very closely aligned. The word capital, one of the definitions of capital is actually wealth in the form created. So here we have this interesting opportunity to redefine progress, redefine wealth in its original, you know, definition. And my argument is that wealth could be defined in terms of five forms of capital, if you like, or five forms of wealth, or human capital, which includes our skills and our aspirations and dreams and health, our social capital, our relationships, the sense of belonging and trust, natural capital, what nature produces already for free that we take for granted, our infrastructure or built capital, what we make out of nature and our human capacities. And then there's financial capital, which I would say is actually an artificial, it's a human-created form of capital, but yet it's still important because we spend so much time and energy on finances. And I see the five capitals as all integrated. They're part of a new balance sheet, if you like, that says that all of these forms of capital together constitutes well-being. And so in this tool or genuine wealth assessment, which I've been applying and trying to use in different capacities from in business and organizations and in countries, is a new way of governing, I would say, an economy of well-being. So let's say that is the new paradigm. It's not an economy of growth for growth's sake. It's an economy to optimize, enhance well-being.
Well, I like that. It's not an economy for growth's sake, because that's
That's like cancer.
An elusive, yes, it's an elusive piece that really doesn't hold anything anywhere. I just heard this comedian's comment about when a corporation, you know, I'd like to see the state of Texas give a corporation the death sentence, then I'll know it's an actual entity. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, something like that. And to hold growth or the importance of growth in business the way it's been held is that same kind of illusion. I know you do help businesses, and that's part of your business. What have you seen on this level of actually working with some kind of corporation or business when they start holding these five pieces for genuine wealth? How does that work for the business?
First of all, I've actually worked with a few companies, mostly governments, mostly municipal governments, who seem to appreciate the importance of that this actually represents the true society. Companies, ironically, you know, that we say that corporations only exist to maximize profits. That's not entirely true. There are a lot of great business leaders who, like Ray Anderson of Interface, who, you know, took it upon themselves to introduce ideas of triple bottom or responsibility for the environment and community. What I found, though, is a lot of companies have actually never sat down and integrated all of their, say, social and community and environmental information with their financials to actually look at their progress actually more holistically. And ironically, when you start to look at this, you can actually find areas of greater efficiency. So, for example, one of the areas I'm looking at now and trying to help companies, and we've just incorporated a company called Happiness Inc., which is to help anybody who hires us to, in a sense, understand that relationships are the most precious thing that any organization has, trust, right, sense of belonging. And this is one of the more difficult things to measure. But yet we know that ultimately, if you're a small business and you don't have good relationships with your clients, you're not going to be in business for very long. So how do we pay attention to the importance of relationships? And relationships actually are the most fundamental driver of happiness. The happiest communities have a strong sense of belonging. So that's been sort of my experience working with business. Business actually is quite conservative. They're not really that progressive. They will only report and account for whatever they're required to under law. You know, I always ask people, you know, would you really keep a set of books if your accountant didn't tell you you had to? And why do we keep books anyways? And most of that is simply for the basis of paying taxes.
But that is so important to start looking at it from a lot of different vantage points. That's so true. I have friends that started a consulting business, which was similar in that they tried to build the community from within the business. And it was a chemical. One of their clients was a chemical company, and they brought it down to accidents in the warehouse. They wanted to bring it down to 2-3%. And that's one of the first things they looked at. They said, okay, do you want to go actually into the warehouse and say, okay, raise your hand if you're going to be part of that 1-3% that has. So they said, okay, let's make our goal zero. Let's start there.
Yeah, let's start there. Let's start at you know, what do we all want? You know, everyone kind of flippantly says, you know, what do you want out of life? I just want to be happy. Well, I don't care if that, you know, that's your definition in the workplace or at home. And then if we were to really optimize, if we really to understand what that means, to unbundle that statement, then I think we would be, you know, you look at the best places to work environments. I think there are places where you find people who are feeling, they feel flow, they feel creative. You know, I know Google, I think they give their employees, every Friday they have their creative day, right? Now imagine if we spent more, you know, we dedicated more time to creativity within companies we work for. And that actually will ultimately lead to greater resilience of the company in the long run.
Sure. You spoke about a contact you had with George Soros, and maybe you can just give us a one or two sentence bio on him. But he said that he got the idea and agreed with your idea of genuine wealth, but said it's not quite ready for prime time. How did that make you feel?
Well, it was interesting. I didn't give it to him directly. It was actually through a friend who runs Corporate Knights magazine, which is a corporate ethics magazine out of Toronto. And he was at the World Economic Forum last January. And he said, would you write a two-page pitch to George Soros on genuine wealth? And I did, and it's on my website, inielski.com, the open letter to him. And I wasn't surprised. Soros is a very smart guy. He's a multi-billionaire. He's made his money in currency trading and hedging against currencies. So he's a multi-billionaire. He's a very smart economist. He's in his 80s. I'm not surprised. What we find is that while economists have started talking about well-being, those who have the greatest influence, particularly over the money system, actually I don't think have any interest in entertaining the ideas. Partly because they already have a pretty good thing going, even though the system right now appears to be in crisis. That's kind of a cynical view. The interesting comment, though, so Soros' response was not surprising to me, though I would love to get on a plane right now and sit with him in New York and say, I think this is your legacy, George. You're financing people like Amy Goodman, Democracy Now! You've got this new economic think tank going. You are in your, late years are interested in some legacy piece. And so I think what he needs to see, I think, is a tangible roadmap for how, and this isn't easy, how are we going to redesign an entire global economy that focuses on well-being as the ultimate, right, objective, and also the equitable distribution of well-being amongst all people. That should be our global agenda. That should be what they'd be talking about at Davos this in a few weeks. Now, the interesting comment came from Karl Koch-Weser, who's the vice chairman of Deutsche Bank. He was there, too, with Soros, and he said to my proposal, I'd be willing to be a Sherpa for the idea to the next G20 with enough detail. So here you have a Deutsche Bank, vice chairman actually thinking about the possibility that this idea is worth test driving if there's a sufficient roadmap for him, right? And so this is what my colleagues and I are now working on, is can we actually give countries and communities a roadmap to develop an economy of well-being?
The whole time you were talking, I just kept thinking of spontaneous remission, not from disease, but from... from economic greed.
Yeah.
We need some of those movers and shakers that hang out in the shadows to have a spiritual emission or something like that that gets shared worldwide.
Well, my whole mission, I guess, is to appeal to people's common sense and their hearts. And, Soros isn't a bad guy. He's made his money doing what he does really well, and so have bankers. But, the fundamental question is what is it that we want to leave here as legacy? I mean, is it a big pile of cash and know that we've got all of these assets that we can't take with us? Or is it, a place, an experience of joy? And I even go as far as saying a civilization of love, which for some people it's like, what are you talking? Now you've gone over the edge. But, let's be serious about why. What is life about? What's the economy for?
Is there one thing you would or could pin on the disappearance of the middle class here?
I would say that we're actually making good progress. I think unwittingly when I look, I say, in the way the crisis is kind of a blessing. It's caused us to rethink. I mean, I've got beautiful magazines like Yes Magazine telling stories of people's changes in the midst of crisis, revisiting things like growing your own food, shopping locally, moving your money out of Wall Street, investing the money locally. There's so many wonderful things happening. Mainstream media maybe not picking up on it, but these are the stories that are emerging. and there are great stories of hope. They call to not a return back to simple agrarianism, but in fact, enjoying the benefits of all of our technology. And my message is that we simply need to begin to have more and more conversations that bring us hope. They're practical tools for reclaiming our sovereignty over our happiness. And we'll discover, actually, that the joy of sharing and the reality of abundance that exists within our communities when we start to reconnect and reestablish meaningful relationships with each other. And I think that's what's going to break the matrix, if you like.
Mark, I thought I'd love for you to share what we were talking about off mic earlier in light of our fundraiser that's coming up and how impressed you were with public radio in the United States.
When my book was published in the United States, I received over 30 radio interview requests, and they were incredible. What impressed me was the spirit and strength of the public radio in the United States. And I actually was very pleasantly surprised that the hosts were informed and they were really engaged. And I thought, what is going on in the United States where everyone is seemingly interested in happiness? So whatever we tapped into was important. And I think we are continuing that work.
Economics 101 at UT, not so good. Economics of happiness, I can go with that one. Many thanks to Mark Anielski. For any guest information, to listen to archives and share resources, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.